Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
What up, what up? Welcome, everybody, to the Michael Steele Podcast. It's so good to have you in the house today. Well, I am excited about two things, because I get to talk with someone that I've admired for a long, long time and whose work I followed. And two, he has a book that I think is a profoundly important book for everyone who pretends to be or wants to be or profoundly is a conservative. So you can get to understand exactly what we're in today. It is none other than the George Will, who writes a twice weekly syndicated column on politics and domestic and foreign affairs for The Washington Post. His new book, which we're going to get into, is The Conservative Sensibility. George, welcome to the podcast, man. It's a great pleasure to have you on.
Glad to be with you.
Well, let's just get right into this, folks. Back in 2016, June of 2016, 3 years ago to the month, you were very succinct when you decided to leave the Republican Party. You said, "This is not my party," end quote. And since that time, I've watched you and listened to you, and I'm really glad and honored that you're part of the work we're doing over at MSNBC, a part of our network over there. You have laid down an argument for conservatism that I think is important. And it goes to not just the history of the party, not just the things that rolled you to the point where you realize this party is no longer yours, but it actually speaks to the potential future for the party. Give us a quick overview of your mindset in writing The Conservative Sensibility, and then we'll get into a little bit of the particulars that you touch on.
The most commonly asked question of conservatives is, what do you want to conserve? And my answer is precise. It is the American founding, which means several things. The natural rights doctrine, which is that our rights precede government, that government is instituted for the limited purpose of securing our rights, our rights to pursue happiness as we define it. The founders also bequeathed us a governmental architecture from James Madison with a separation of powers of, I believe, congressional supremacy and a restrained executive, which is, after our Article 2 of the Constitution, mm-hmm. Congress's Article 1. And under the Article 2, the primary duty of the president is to take care that the laws are faithfully executed, which makes him secondary and subordinate to the Congress. And so we've had this long-running argument throughout the 20th century between the founders' vision and the progressives' vision. The progressives were remarkably forthright, Michael, in overthrowing in rejecting the founders' vision, and remarkably successful, I'm bound to say, in giving us what we now have today, which is no longer what we thought we had, a government of limited, delegated, and enumerated powers. So what I'm trying to do with my book is revive an argument, reconnect us with the founders, and particularly reconnect conservatism with the Madisonian limited government vision.
Well, you know, and I profoundly agree with that effort, because I think it served as the basis for conservatism, and it certainly, as we come to know it, as a young man myself, who was fashioned by the 60s, 70s, and 80s, I gravitated towards that idea of you know, recognizing that we're all created equal. We have natural rights that have been given to us. We have the right to own our property, and the government has a very limited role in all of that. But what's happened? I mean, what I was struck by about the conservative sensibility is you never mentioned Donald Trump. you don't waste your time, and I put it that way deliberately, getting lost in the weeds that have grown up, in my estimation, within conservative ranks and within the Republican Party as a political institution writ large, from Trumpism. You focus on something that's more important and fundamentally more profound, and that is the very thing you talked about, as you set out the book about those things that are self-evident. What went wrong? How have we gone so far afield here as a conservative movement, as a conservative idea in this age?
This is not another Washington book. Lord knows the bookshelves groan beneath the weight of books deploring this and deploring that. This is a book that says we began to go wrong long before the 2016 election. This is a book that says our departure from the framers' intent, the successful progressive revolution against the framers' intent of limited government, that really began with Woodrow Wilson, who was the first president to thoroughly criticize the American founding, that this has been a long project. Michael, in 1964, I cast my first vote for president, and mm-hmm. I cast it enthusiastically for Barry Goldwater, to the memory of whom, by the way, the book is dedicated. Mm-hmm. In 1964, 70% of the American people said they trusted the federal government to do the right thing all the time or almost all the time. Today, that number is below 20%.
Yeah.
Now, we have seen in the last 50, 60 years the pretensions of government grow and the prestige of government plummet. And I would think progressives, particularly since all of their agenda depends on trust in a strong government,
yes, right.
They would be particularly interested in what has gone wrong. And what we need and what we're having and what I hope my book contributes to is a thoroughgoing debate about the proper scope and actual competence of government.
Well, I guess for me, that's always been an interesting balance and an important one. I know that my idea of government and its function and certainly its limitations was challenged and tested, I think, appropriately when I got elected Lieutenant Governor of Maryland. Because for the first time now, it was no longer about the rhetoric and the slogans and, you know, the sort of haranguing against government, to quote Reagan, you know, about the government coming to help you. Yeah, you don't want any of that, right? But then you realize that it does have, I began to see it as a limited purpose entity, that it has a role to play. Which I think goes to your point, why back in the 60s there was such a popular trust in the government to play that role. But the government had to understand what that role was. And I would contend today the government hasn't. And we can get into, and I think a clear example of that is the executive power. Which you spared no rod there. You really go after the modern day presidency as a pernicious conflation of the function of a government executive with this overwhelming sense of importance. Right? I mean, is that where we
absolutely
are right?
Absolutely. And again, this is a century long. Event, whoever was president today would be exercising powers that he should not have, powers that have been given to him by a Congress that is either too lazy or too risk-averse to have to accept the accountability of actually legislating. So what increasingly Congress does is offload on the executive branch all the difficult trade-offs and decisions. They pass sort of aspirations. We shall all have a clean environment. What does that mean? Well, over to the executive branch, you guys fill in the details. We should have quality education. What's it mean? We're not going to say. We in the Congress are going to sit back and allow all the hard choices and details to be written by other people who will get the blame for anything controversial, whereas Congress can preen as having endorsed some lofty but completely ill-defined goal.
The New York Times, I thought, wrote a particularly interesting piece about the book, and you could tell that they, at least from my reading of the article, there were parts of it that I don't think they really kind of got. They didn't get George Will. so much. But in the main, they did. And one of the things they noted was, quote, they say, restraint, prudence, skepticism, awe, responsibility, and ease in modernity are virtues that can be found in the very American variety of conservatism that you talk about. Tell us a little bit about how those words play in how you look at conservatism and what lessons should we be taking now as, to be quite honest, we look about and around about life after this period of Trump and where conservatism is now.
Well, American conservatism and the phrase American conservatism, the adjective American, carries a lot of weight. We're not like continental European conservatism, the conservatism of throne and altar, blood and soil, nationalism, the conservatism that was evolved in Europe to defend existing hierarchies and institutions. American conservatism, in sharp contrast, is linked to our belief in free markets and a dynamic market society and the virtues of capitalism, which conservatives say makes us not only better off, but better,
right,
by enforcing certain stern virtues, thrift, industriousness, deferral of gratification, all the rest. American conservatives have a strong libertarian impulse. Now, we're not anarchists. We understand that a free market is a government creation. That is, it needs laws, courts, contracts, adjudication, arbitration, fraud laws, all the rest. But when a society opts for free market capitalism, it is opting for a certain kind of person. Hamilton wanted the kind of society we have. Jefferson wanted a slow-moving rural society, thinly populated with agricultural yeomen.
Right.
Rather like Jefferson.
Right.
And Hamilton wanted restless, entrepreneurial people, rather like Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we live in Hamilton's country, and for that, I'm very glad.
Yeah, I think that's right, and that's the exciting part, that you do have this restlessness and this energy. But the truth and the reality, as I see it, and certainly one of the great frustrations for me over the past year, has been watching some incredibly important thinkers, political leaders, idea people, leave conservatism. Leave the Republican Party, which is has been the home of conservatism since Goldwater, and certainly has sort of updated, if you will, by Reagan and his leadership at the time. I guess I grapple with this reality in the sense that you have individuals like yourself, and I have to tell you honestly, when you decided to walk away from the party, I thought it was a serious message, a serious omen for the party, to be quite honest, because it wasn't just the politics, it was also the philosophical moorings. I mean, you and a handful of others have been the folks who've kind of steered the philosophy, the thinking, the underpinnings of the conservative movement, and given it the sort of intellectual heft to compete out there in policy and domestic and foreign and things like that. They're now walking away, George. Guys like me are saying, look, I'm going to be the last SOB in the House. I'm going to stand at the door and keep fighting the herds, the hordes that are trying to come in. What do you see now? I mean, how does this play itself out? Does the conservative movement find itself intellectually bereft of the kind of superpower that guys like you brought to the conversation, and we're just left with the sort of meandering crazy that I listened to from the White House yesterday, or what? Help me out here. Should I just leave with the rest of them and turn the lights out, or is it worth
so.
The fight?
I think I have no objection to people who feel that working within the Republican Party is what they want to do. That's fine. The identities of parties are not fixed over time.
Right.
I mean, remember, the Republican Party has had fissures in it since 1912, when Teddy Roosevelt decided he wanted the White House back and ran against an incumbent Republican president, William Howard Taft. This rivalry between conservative and moderate Republicans was replicated in the 1940s when Dewey was against Ohio's great conservative Senator Robert Taft. In the 1960s, it was Barry Goldwater against the Rockefeller Republicans. This is perhaps conservatism and Republicans' strongest and longest tradition,
right,
is vigorous debate within the party. I think, however, that I am most useful standing away from the party and saying, look, the conservative movement has an enormously impressive pedigree of intellectual ideas. Lincoln, Madison, Hamilton, Jefferson, up to the president through Hayek and others.
Right.
Therefore, the idea that this wonderful political and intellectual tradition is going to disappear because the Republican Party is not at the moment as receptive to it as we wish it were, is too pessimistic. This tradition is too rich, too strong, and too vital to go away.
Yeah, I appreciate that, but I have to be honest, we've got a whole bunch of numbnuts running things right now. and I think that's lost on these guys, and I want to bring it into the current space. So Justin Amash, who a conservative Republican member of Congress, who did what responsible members should do when they get a report like the Mueller report. He read it and concluded that there were things in there that should be troubling to every member, and sided with those who wanted a greater inquiry. The backlash for someone like him, who has a stellar conservative record, if it mattered at all boiled down to you don't support Donald Trump. It wasn't whether or not you're right or wrong in your assessment of the Mueller report, or we have to execute our, going back to the conversation we just had about the executive authority and sort of the diminishment of Congress. And this is a way for us to reestablish that. It became this thing where he's now decided, look, screw this. I'm out of the Freedom Caucus. You guys continue to do what you're going to do. If you've got this continual push within the movement itself that is so personal and political as opposed to founded on principle, if he came out and said something that was counter to some of the fundamental ideas that you talk about in the conservative sensibility, that's one thing. But that's not where we are right now. So how do you – I don't see how you recover from this when you've got these sort of loonies still controlling the outcome of things.
Well, first of all, if these people should lose the next election, that will get their attention.
Yeah, that's true.
There's nothing like a resounding rejection by the voters for people to say, maybe we ought to rethink the path we're on. But, a lot of Americans seem to me today to be addicted to anger. I'm not angry at anybody.
Right.
I'm disappointed. I think, like most Americans, I'm sad and embarrassed. And I'm sad because I am embarrassed about the conduct of our most conspicuous political institutions. But if Americans approach one another with a modicum of goodwill, things can change in a hurry in this country. One of the most gratifying things about modern America is how open we are to swift improvement. The example I'm fondest of, I say, watch an SEC football game. Alabama playing Mississippi.
Yes.
And the guy in the striped shirt, the head referee, is an African-American, and he's bossing everyone around. And he's leading what the South, the Deep South, takes most seriously, college football.
Yes.
And people who don't think America can change in a hurry and for the better have just missed the last 50 years.
They have. But that brother realizes he's in a dangerous spot, too. So he's got to be careful with those calls because, oh, man, those rivalries are fierce. But I think that's probably, for me, that's important. I mean, that sense that you have I appreciate the contact sport of politics.
Yes.
But there is, I think, we've kind of gone beyond that in so many ways, where it has become much more personal. It's a lot less forgiving, and I think it's a lot less appreciative of what it is to be an American. It's sort of the shaping this new ideology of, you know, what we, this small group of people, think is the correct thing. And this is where I have a problem, and I really appreciate how you I will put it this way, you deftly handled the faith and religion conundrum in conservatism. And I just, on that point, when I look at the evangelical community and I look at the religious right, and knowing and understanding the history of their, you know, being politicized and brought into a process, Republicans generally and conservatives in particular, before 1980 and putting, you know, the pro-life plank in the platform and all that, we're fairly agnostic on these things. They sort of left those individuals. I guess that's sort of our libertarian nature, was this, hey, you do you, boo, in your community, and, you know, we'll make sure the government doesn't get in the way, but that's up to you. Today, that's not necessarily the case. How is faith and religion now driving conservatism and reshaping it?
Well, particularly the evangelical Christians in America have gone all in on the current president,
right,
which is any American's free choice. The problem is that there are a large number of Americans who have a different religion, a different understanding of the proper relationship of religion to government, and a large number of Americans who have no faith at all. In fact, the people who identify as nuns, N-O-N-E-S, no religious faith, are more numerous today than all the mainstream Protestants combined. Mm. So a political persuasion, such as conservatism, that seems to treat them as beyond the pale, as not eligible for membership in the movement, is dooming itself to marginalization. So it seems to me that we ought to understand what Bill Buckley said. Bill put it very well. He said, a conservative need not be religious, but he cannot despise religion. I think that's exactly right. The great religions are great for a reason. They address permanent human anxieties and aspirations and curiosities. Therefore, one respects them, but one need not be religious in order to be a conservative.
Yeah. I think more people need to come to that perspective, because they've kind of driven this narrative for Trump especially, and of course he uses it to his own advantage. But I think that there's been much more profound link between the two in a way that I think is more harmful, particularly when I look at how they slide away from the tenets of their own teaching, their own evangelization. You talk about people, George, who condemned whole swaths of Americans for how they lived, who they loved, etc., who now look at this guy as if he's, you know, delivering the Beatitudes on the Sermon on the Mount. I don't get it.
Well, this is another example of how Americans have changed. In 2004, in order to run up the Republican turnout in states like Ohio, the George W. Bush campaign helped get on the ballot referenda to disapprove of same-sex marriage. Again, a subject about which Americans and intelligent people of goodwill can disagree. I understand that. And it worked. They pulled out a lot of people who were opposed to same-sex marriage. 15 years later, Michael, you wouldn't think of doing that.
Right.
It's a closed question. Yeah. Americans have said, got it, we're moving on. And again, that's a sign of national health, I think.
Well, a sign of national health. That's actually well put. So let's talk about that national health. As you noted in a piece back in May of this year, headlined the impeachment would be a debacle. You note, quote, if congressional Democrats will temper their enthusiasm for impeachment with lucidity about the nation's needs and their political self-interest, they will understand the self-defeating nature of a foredoomed attempt to remove a president for aesthetic reasons, end quote. That's how your opening salvo in the impeachment debate. That was May 31st. We're now in the middle of June. Has anything changed?
Well, except every day that goes by, every minute the clock ticks, we're closer to an election. Which is, if you think you've had a bad election, have a better one. Get so on true. To the next election. But, I mean, the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November is bearing down on us from 2020. In the first place, no one believes that a Republican Senate will, if they receive articles of impeachment from the House, remove the president. It's right. Not going to happen. Second, impeachment can be retrospective. That is, it can be removal of office for bad deeds done. And you say, well, what bad deed? And they're going to say, well, abuse of power in covering up an investigation, like firing Comey. Well, A, when he fired Comey, he was exercising a core presidential power to change the staffing of the executive branch. Second, he could have ended, he could have fired Mueller. Did ask his White House counsel to do it, but when the counsel refused, Trump didn't follow up. So the investigation went ahead, and the investigation was into an offense that it turns out the investigation decided the president didn't commit. So a retrospective impeachment doesn't make much sense. Now, you can also impeach to prevent further damage, and that would get to the president's comportment in office, the dissembling and the name-calling and all the rest, which I think has lasting damage to our civic culture. But this is the president as we knew him on Election Day 2016. People knew what they were getting, and he won the election. You can hardly impeach a person for being what he said he was and what he said he was going to continue being.
I've been saying that. I mean, that is so true, because the one thing about Trump, regardless of anything else you may think or say or feel about him, he has been straight up about what he is. He's not hidden any of that. He has come, you know, to the table and pretty much showed you his hand. And I mean, in that sense, he can make the case. Well, the American people bought it. They bought it in 15 and 16. They elected me. And his argument going into next year is going to be pretty much the same. I haven't changed. Everyone else is coming at me, and I'm still here. And the question is whether or not people will continue to buy what he's selling in that regard. I think that's going to be the real test. I say, George, you know, we are where we are, and this kind of touches on I think, the book, The Conservative Sensibility, but more broadly, the American sensibility. We are where we are because this is where we want to be. And we don't move off of this point until we decide we're ready to do that.
But America is always on the move. And there's the one constant in American life is inconstancy. It's change. And the future's open. Public opinion determines everything. Public opinion is shiftable sand. And my book is an attempt to shift some sand.
Well, it's a well-done attempt. And I think it's an important read right now. I think a lot of people would learn a lot, understand and contextualize a lot of the moments that they sit at their kitchen table scratching their heads going, what the hell is going on? Folks, if you want to get an understanding and appreciation, pick up a copy of The Conservative Sensibility by the one and only George Will. It's a great read. It's an important book. And certainly, it's a light for me. And I felt better after reading it because I had a better appreciation for not just my history, but the potential future. And, George, you did a great job with it, my friend.
Appreciate it. Good to be with you.
It's great to have you, George. All right, folks, that wraps it up for this wonderful conversation. But certainly check us out on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcasts on. You can find George Will on Twitter at George Will. You can find me at Michael Steele. This is the Michael Steele Podcast. Take care, folks.
step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.